Welcome to the What's Percolating teleconference, discussing the latest in heartfelt mind, body, and spirit for peace, passion, and prosperity. Now here are your hosts, Gary Kobat and Elizabeth Hamilton Garino.
Well, finally, we're getting a little drizzle here in Los Angeles. How's everybody this afternoon? This is Gary Kobat.
And I'm Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, and I'd welcome rain over more snow, I think. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm in Falmouth, Maine, and wow. There's just piles of snow out there. I'm just not even going to look.
That's great.
So, are we percolating or what?
Thank you. All day, as a matter of fact. For 3 days,
we've got
20 shows. This is our marathon of radio shows, so to speak. And we're in day three of a four-day, five-show-per-day conference. And earlier today we had David James Elliott, who was sharing with us amazing things like riding 100 miles with Lance and I and on and on and on. And it sounds like that's just an enormous amount what you can do with the mind and the body, but you haven't heard anything yet because our guest in a few minutes has surpassed that by an enormous amount, and I'd love to get into that with him. And last night, oh my gosh, we had J.P. Howell from the Dodgers. That was in his beautiful wife, Heather, and it's our first couple on air, and they talked about the challenges of not only being a pro athlete, but the travel and the circadian rhythms and sleep, because their sleep is upside down and they don't get home until, you know, midnight to one. And
puppy doggy.
And exactly. Like, who takes care of the dog and so forth.
Yeah.
And that was just amazing. And Kevin Sorbo, oh my gosh, he's Hercules, but suffered
survivor.
A stroke. And his work coming back and making film again. And then, oh my gosh, I'll have Elizabeth tell you about replays and downloads. But our largest download so far in 2.5 days is Mitch Gaylord. So we had Mitch Gaylord, 84 Olympic gold medal winner, on yesterday, and that was just tremendous. So we've got a great show ahead. Elizabeth, can you tell them how to be involved?
Oh, absolutely. You can listen at 714-868-0220, or you can go to our conference page, which is besteveryou.com/teleconference. And one of the, I don't know if you runners use coffee at all, I'm guessing probably not, but if the entire conference is sponsored by iCoffee, and I love this, everybody who registers for our conference is automatically entered to win an iCoffee. We'll be doing a drawing at the end of the teleconference for one winner. And before we go, we just need to thank Blog Talk Radio, I think, also. Don't you think, Gary? We better give some kudos and props to everybody at Blog Talk Radio, because a few months ago we came up with this idea, and they didn't quite know what to do with us. And so they've opened their hearts and their technology and their minds to really making this conference happen with 5 shows a day, 5 hours of programming and chat rooms and call-ins and everything. And the David James Elliott show, people... I think we blew out the chat room.
Smiled.
That was great.
So that's great. We learn, right? We live and we learn, and we have an awesome time. So without any further ado, we've got the race director of the Boston Marathon, the philanthropist in the New England area, this motivational speaker, and not only that, he's an amazing dad, he's an amazing human being, he's an accomplished athlete, bar none. And it's no other than Dave McGillivray. Dave, welcome into the show.
Hey, geez, with all those studs you've had on the last 3 or 4 days or whatever, I don't know what the heck I'm doing here, but flattered and honored to be on your show.
Humble.
Thank you very much.
Oh,
really,
my God. It's such a great... You know, Dave's the kind of guy, in 1978, started in Medford, Oregon, and finished in Medford, Mass., 3,452-mile run. I mean, please.
What?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you kidding? No, you're serious. I know you guys are serious. We're not kidding. What? Repeat that one more time.
Okay. Medford,
oh,
Oregon,
gosh,
to Medford,
Oregon,
Massachusetts. That's 3,452 miles. And
how can you do something like that?
Well, he does.
I lost my plane ticket. You know, I had to get home.
I guess so.
Had to get home.
Giving you a ride.
No, and yeah. And just to give you another kind of idea who we're talking to here,
wow.
is, you know, I might have 52 marathons or I might have 500,000 miles on a bike, but it doesn't even compare. It's pennies compared to Dave. Dave ran a couple years later 1,520 miles from Winter Haven, Florida, to Boston. And again, each time he's raising money for the Jimmy Fund and for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. So Dave, let's just start there. Like, what inspires something like that? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, you know, it all started, Gary and Elizabeth, when I was, you know, a young boy, and I wanted to be one thing and one thing only, and that was an athlete. And, you know, but I had a challenge, if you will, and my challenge was that I was vertically challenged. And so I was the smallest kid around, and, you know, all my friends were bigger and stronger, and any time my friends fucked up for sides, you know, in the playgrounds, you know, they'd pick Pete or Ralph or Fred or Joe or Sally or Jane. They picked the girls over me, and they go, oh, okay, we got Dave, you know. And what that did to me mentally and emotionally was devastating. You know, no, I didn't have an illness. I didn't have, God forbid, cancer or heart condition. But what I had was something that really debilitated me, or at least was on the border of such. And I was always the last one cut in school when I went out for sports. So by default, I just started running because nobody can cut you from running. And I just said, well, if you can't go left, you go right in life. You know, there's always a road to travel. Don't give up. And so since then, I've run about 150,000 miles. And I just started setting all these, you know, all these physical goals and running across the country, up the East Coast, doing 24-hour swims, 24-hour bike rides, 24-hour swims, doing the Ironman in Hawaii 8 times, doing running my age on my birthday when I was 12. I ran 12 miles, 13. I just turned 59, ran 59 miles on my 59th birthday. And,
wow.
You know, so I continue to do these things because that's who I am, and I want to challenge myself. And you know, I want to stay connected to what I was able to do, even though I'd set different goals and different expectations. So, and I, you know, I started doing these things and realizing that if I'm going to do this at that length and to make that kind of commitment, why not put it together, combine it with philanthropy, with giving back? And I, in fact, I'm heading to Fenway Park right now for a function, and I was working at the John Hancock Tower at the time, and I looked out the window, and I saw Fenway Park where the Red Sox play, and I saw a sign out in right field, and it said, help make a dream come true, support the Jimmy Fund. And the Jimmy Fund is the fundraising arm of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I thought, you know, what better thing to do than to, you know, run across the country and raise money for cancer research for kids who need our help. And even Runner's World wrote an article, I think last year in the May issue, saying that was the first time on record that they heard that anybody combined running with raising money for cancer research. And then you can only imagine what's happening in the world today. So that's generally why I do what I do.
So how do you do it? How do you fuel that? How do you take care of your body? Is your body breaking down? I mean, you're 59 now. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, people say to me, well, you run your age on your birthday. What the heck are you going to do when you turn 90? You know, and I don't know. I mean, first of all, I want to be breathing, and then, you know, I got to get out of bed, and then we'll see. You know, I have a motto in life, and my motto is, it's my game, so it's my rules. And I've lived my life that way, you know, every day of my life that way. But the whole theory behind that is you do what you want to do. You do what's important to you. You make a commitment. You earn the right. You go do it. And this is, I want to do this. It makes me feel good. And it's just like what's going on in the industry today. You know, races are selling out at record pace. Why? Because the walls of intimidation have crumbled, and people are believing in themselves. I started my business, CMFE, Inc., putting on events 35 years ago. And when I started it, people were saying, what are you, crazy? You're going to try to earn a living putting on road races? And I said, well, you might think that they're road races right now, and they may be, but down the road, they're not going to be just road races. you know, and people say, well, what do you do for a living? And I used to always mumble, I'm a race director. And they're like, what the heck is that? Chalk mark on the road, you go. And, you know, they go down the street and you give them a bowl of beef stew and say, now get out of here. And back then, yeah, that's what it was. And now people say to me, what do you do for a living? I say, well, I have raised a level of self-esteem and self-confidence of tens of thousands of people in America. Because that is what's going on now, is that people are believing in themselves. They're having the guts to sign an application to enter an event. They're training real hard, earning the right. They're participating. They cross the finish line, get their medal, and go home feeling good about themselves. There's nothing better in the world than that. That's the platform. That's the foundation for being successful at everything else you do during the day and in your life. You have to have confidence and self-esteem. You're toast. You're doomed in life.
Exactly. And every footstep.
I'm bringing in Julie Vick for a minute here because, Julie Vick, hello. You are listening in the chat room. I can see you. Hello, Julie Vick. And that probably just completely spoke to her. And
yeah, Julie's
Julie
47.
Vick.
Julie's 47. We met a year ago. She's lost 70 pounds, and we entered her into Toronto Marathon. She's from Toronto. And she said, well, I can't run. And I said, you can walk. And she said, I do. I walk every day. I don't own a car. So she walks to work and she walks back. So we created a training plan around walking. And she walked her marathon at Toronto in October at, I think, 5 hours and 50 minutes walking.
Wow.
And, yeah, and she has that medal. No one will ever take it away from her and or anybody. And I loved what you just said, that it's not a race. It's a connection with yourself.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Julie has a vision one day, Dave, to run the Boston Marathon. So we'll keep focusing on that.
Yep.
That's awesome. When did you decide to be, or how did you get involved, like, as race director? I know you started an event company.
Well, after I had run across the country, you know, I was... My colleagues convinced me to open up an athletic footwear and clothing store in my hometown of Medford, Mass., where I finished. And then I started putting on a few events just to promote the store. And then I realized I liked putting on events more than shoes on people's feet. So I took a chance, right? And I just said, I'm just going to make a career out of this. I'm going to combine a hobby with a vocation. And it's amazing. I do a lot of motivational speaking when I speak, especially to school children, they say to me, so, Dave, you do all this running. What do you do for work? And I said, well, I don't. And they say, you don't work? And I said, no, not in the conventional sense of the word, because I think people work gives the impression that you're doing something to earn a living, to make money, punching a clock 9 to 5. That's what the majority of people in the world do. I don't want to be like that. I want to get up every morning wanting to get up and wanting to do the things that I'm going to be doing all day long. I'm passionate about it. So I don't consider what I do work because I enjoy what I do so much. I'm just very, very fortunate that I've been able to make a business out of this. And I've directed over 1,000 events in the last 30-some-odd years and put on events all over the country, all over the world, in Singapore, Peru, in the Caribbean, in Europe. Every major city in America.
Wow.
I mean, I've directed everything from helping with the consulting on the Atlanta Olympic Games, Salt Lake City Olympic Games. I've directed the U.S. Olympic Trials and the Marathon for the Women in St. Louis, in Boston, Goodwill Games and Triathlon in downtown Manhattan. I directed the second Triathlon World Championship at Walt Disney World in Florida. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Boston now, this is my 27th year. Working on that event. So I've been very fortunate to be associated with and involved with some of the most iconic events, in the country, in the world. If they didn't pay me to do the job, I'd still want to do it.
Wow. So tell us, like me, we've got some event planners, I'm sure, listening, and even if they're not officially called an event planner, everybody is an organizer, an event planner for themselves. What kind of tips can you kind of give us, just off the top of your head? Like, you've done so many. I mean, what just come right out and say, this is important, this is important, this is a key, this is a pillar?
Well, for me, you know, the number one thing I want to accomplish you know, when producing an event or just anywhere, anytime, is to earn trust and earn respect. I'm putting on a new event in Annapolis, Maryland, in November over the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. It's a 10K over the bridge. And we opened registration a few months ago, and we already have 20,000 people registered for it.
Wow.
All right, for a 10K road race. And so when I go into an area like that, I mean, the first thing I want to do is, with the community and with all the public safety agencies and everything else, I want them to trust me and to respect me. And then, you know, from that point forward, I think we can work well together. So a lot of it comes down to, you know, just discipline, organizational skills, you know, just trying to be a leader. I mean, there's just so much to it. You know? But it's a labor of love. It's labor intensive. But I wouldn't change it for the world.
Can we talk about kids for a minute?
Oh, great.
Or
uh-huh.
two or three or four or ten.
yeah.
Well, running is so great for children and getting up off their duffs and off in front of the computer and out and running around and doing all these things. What's available out there? I know the answer to this, but I'd love you to talk about it. What's out there and available to children beginning at a very young age regarding track and field?
Well, I mean, I'm in more the road race business versus the track and field business, but
okay.
I'm a firm believer that you know, that obviously the children are the future of our sport, and you have to get them interested early on. And even if it's to run in order to stay fit, to participate in other sports or other disciplines, that's okay. It's a means to an end. But so in all our events, we do have, you know, ancillary events that focus on the kids. And arguably, they're the ones that get, those events are the ones that get the most attention. You know, whether it's, again, we get 700, 800, 1,000, 2,000 kids coming to our events to participate, whether it's a 100-yard dash, a quarter-mile run, a half-mile run, a mile run, it doesn't matter. It's all about participation. And it's the same in this entire industry of ours. I mean, years ago, it was all about competition. You know, I could go to a race, and I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I'm going to finish 7th. I knew everyone in it. I knew their ability level that day, and I knew pretty much things go according to schedule, where I was going to finish. Now, it's not about just about competition. It's about participation. You know, it's about getting in the game. And it starts at a young age, and that's what's so great about what's going on now.
Yeah, and I just see so many of these kids. The reason why I said track and field, too, is because it just seems like it's like this like seed that gets planted about running and so forth. And I'm not a runner, so you could probably tell, I'm sure. But I see so many children. I'm children running marathons or half marathons with their parents. Many of my friends have children that run marathons, and I am amazed at the youth participation in marathon running. I think it's so cool.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, it's simple. You know, you just lace up the shoes and go out the door. It's not expensive. You don't have to buy all this equipment and join all these teams and travel all over the place and get ice time or pool time or court time. You just lace on the shoes and go. So it's convenient. It's affordable. The residual benefits in terms of, you know, making you feel better physically, mentally, emotionally, and like I said, even with these kids, it's all about feeling better about themselves. You know, it was interesting to morph into a different group. I once was asked if I would come into a maximum security prison to run against the inmates. And they first reached out to Bill Rogers and asked him if he would do it, and he kindly took a pass, smart guy that he is. And then, of course, said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. So I went in, and you know, I decided to run this 10K race inside of a prison yard against about 300 other inmates. And make a long story short, I ended up winning that race. They respected me, and then I came back and put on a whole bunch of other events in there, and developed this whole running club inside the prison and that whatnot. But then I got, ridiculed because people would say to me, they say, "Why are you doing that? You know, there's so many other people in the world that could use your help that are worthy of your goodness. Why are you helping those who are in a maximum security prison?" And I said, "Well, my theory is that, someday a lot of these guys are going to get out. And I'd rather have them a little bit better on the way out than they were on the way in, right? And running can do that." I said, I'm not doing anything else for them or with them other than just giving them an opportunity to run, because then they're going to start feeling that they can accomplish things in life, they can right the ship, they can be a better person because they feel better about themselves, and that's the end product of what you see going on in the world today in our industry.
Talk to us about those first year or two of the Boston Marathon that you were involved in. What was that like, and how has it changed?
Well, the first Boston that I ran in, it was 1972, and talk about, not earning the right. I just decided that morning I was going to get up and run the marathon, and because I had heard about it, and, I was a runner, but not, the furthest I had ever run was 11 miles. So I called my grandfather, who was a supporter of my athleticism, and I said, "Grandpa, I'm going to go run that race in Boston." He goes, "Oh, they call that the Boston Marathon." I said, "Well, isn't that a coincidence? All right, fine. Yeah, well, I'm going to go do that." He said, "Well, I'll meet you at Coolidge Corner." And I said, "Where's that?" He said, "At the 24-mile mark," because he lived right almost on the course. I said, "Fine." So off we took off, and I got to the hills in Newton, around 18, 19 miles, and down I went, flat out, and I got taken to the Newton Wellesley Hospital in an ambulance. And
wow.
I got home eventually, and I called my grandfather, and there's no answer. Called him again, no answer. Finally, 9 o'clock at night, he answers the phone. I said, "Grandpa, where've you been?" He said, "Dave, where've you been?" He says, "I've been waiting for you all night." The old man goes by, the street sweepers go by, no Dave. And I said, "Well, I apologize, I failed." He says, "Nah, you didn't fail." I said, "I didn't. What'd I do?" He said, "You learned." I said, "What'd I learn?" He said, "You learned you cannot go along in life and set reckless goals. You had no business doing that. You didn't earn the right to participate in that race." And I said, "You're right." He says, "I cut another deal with you." And I said, "What?" He says, "You train next year, and I'll be there." I said, "Fine." Well, 2 months later, he died. But I said, "I'm going to do this in memory of Grandpa." So I trained like the dickens. I was running 120, 130 miles a week. I was fit for that next year. I officially registered. I was ready to go, and the day before I got a stomach virus and I couldn't run. And my parents said, no, you can't run. You're too sick. I said, "Can you give me one thing that no one else has ever given me in my life?" And my parents said, "What's that?" I said, "A chance. Can you just give me a chance?" I said, "Let me toe the line. I feel like garbage today, but tomorrow I could feel better. Who knows? Let the day dictate itself." Fine. They brought me out there. I took off. I got to the point where I dropped out the year before. I'm doing the survivor shuffle over the hill. I had nothing in the tank. I'm working off of, the bottom of the barrel. There's nothing there. And at 21 and a half miles, I drop out again. So here I am, this kid who gets cut from every sport, who's the last pick with all his friends, who drops out of his first Boston Marathon, drops out of his second Boston Marathon. You can imagine how I felt like a loser, that I'm just going to go nowhere in life. And all of a sudden, a defining moment happened, and I looked up at the right where I was. I never had been in that part of Boston before, except once, and I looked around, and there's the cemetery they buried my grandfather. And there's his tombstone. And that son of a gun said he'd be here. And he was.
Wow.
Spiritually, maybe not physically, but he was there spiritually. And I picked myself up. I said, "He kept his end of the bargain. I'm going to keep mine." And I finished that year's marathon in 4.5 hours. I crossed the finish line. I said, "I'm going to run this race every year for the rest of my life in honor and tribute of the lesson that my grandfather taught me to earn the right to do things." And I've run it every year since, 41 consecutive years in a row.
That's an amazing. I have goosebumps. I'm just listening. I was with every footstep there with you. I'll just back this up. I just want to support what he just said. So I've had the honor, and Dave supported myself and people like David James Elliott and Will Ferrell we've brought, and other people as well. And each time I'm there, I've run the five times. Each time I'm there, here's Dave, okay, starting after the marathon finishes. So
right.
He literally starts his race when his job is pretty much done and he can hand it off and delegate a few things to his great team.
Aww.
And then he starts when it's starting to get dark. And he finishes where everybody finishes as the last finisher, but obviously we respect him so much. And I love where he says, build trust and build respect. I respect Dave so much because he walks his talk. And he has run every year since. And we do see him. So we come out. I've come out on many a times, Dave. I've come out there, and you're just coming across the line. Because I know you're coming, and there's just a handful of people, and they know he's going to be coming in. And where I'm always asking around, when's he coming? Where's he at? Is he walking? Has he told us where he's at? And I just love that moment. So not only our clients are running their first race, they're their best race, and then myself get a chance to participate again. To me, Boston's not really Boston until I go back out and see Dave finish. So
I appreciate that. I always have felt and will continue to feel that I'm an athlete first. And when I took the job, I had run 15 in a row, and then they offered me the job, and I had a difficult decision to make. Do I run a race, direct it, run it, or run in it? And I don't know what to do. And then I said, I need the money. I'll take the job. So I took the job, but that year when everyone was crossing the finish line and I'm standing there, man, I had a real pit in my stomach saying, this is not right. Something's wrong with this picture. So I tapped a state police trooper on the shoulder, you know, and I said to him, I said, officer, can you do me a favor? And he said, what's that? I said, can you bring me back up to the start? And he said, sure, why? Did you forget something? And I said, yeah, I forgot to run, you know. And so he brought me out there, and I started at 8 o'clock at night, and I finished at around 11.
Exactly.
Dead last.
Did he drive alongside you, or how's that go?
Oh, no, I was on my own, you know. And my brother came out in a car, and he leapfrogged me and gave me water or whatever. But so I've done that now for the last 26 years, you know, gone back out at night and brought it in. And, you know, obviously it's getting really tough now as you get older. And, you know, the race gets, you know, larger and more pressure and more anxiety and the stakes are higher. You know, it's not the best way to kind of, you know, start a marathon is to kind of direct it right before you. You know, I'm out there at 3, 4 in the morning on my feet all day, and then I'm on a lead vehicle motorcycle for 2 hours, and then I'm running around the finish line, and I'm not eating, and I'm not resting. And it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, you got to go back out there and now run this damn thing.
Yeah.
It's a high bar.
It's the calm after the storm. I wouldn't have it any different. I'm really looking forward to it for obvious reasons this year.
I know everybody can't relate that's listening that might not be able to relate, like, I'm just going to jump into a marathon. But they can relate to the human stories here he's telling. Like, it's not all success right at the beginning. And another story I'm hearing, too, I don't know if everybody else is, and that is what the human body can actually take, okay, with a little respect to it, obviously, as well.
Yeah.
You know,
go ahead.
What I'm hearing still since you started talking is being picked last. It just won't go away out of my head. And I'm thinking of all the little kids out there in the world who get picked last. And I'm thinking when I was in school, I did something. I used to pick those kids first intentionally.
Yeah.
And always.
Yeah.
Always. And I knew it was coming, and I knew they'd feel bad, and I was kind of mindful of it for some reason. I'm really curious. Do you have your own children? And are you of that? Because that really is a crappy feeling. It's so.
Oh, it really is. And you know, I eventually wrote a book called The Last Pick, you know, for obvious reasons. And people say to me all the time, "What's your book about?" I say, well, it's about the person reading it, you know. In other words, everybody can identify with this because none of us have always had the easy street, the easy life. We've all had hurdles to overcome. None of us are immune, and it's all how you deal with it. You know, we all get it. It's just some deal with it differently than others, right? And you know, it was funny. I talked to you about that prison. And there was this guy in the prison who extraordinary guy. And I went up to him after one of the races, and I said, Ralph, I said, I swore I'd never ask you guys why, how you got here, like what happened. But I'm going to ask you because, I mean, this guy was fit. He was just so fit. And I said, why are you here? He said, well, when I was in college, I went to the University of Arizona, and I was a wrestler. And he said, I won everything. And then I missed making the U.S. Olympic team by one spot. I said, you missed making by one spot. He goes, yeah. I said, so in other words, you felt like you were cut, right? You didn't make it, you were cut. He goes, yeah. And I said, well, when I was young too, Ralph, you know, I was cut too. But see, Ralph chose a different route, a different path.
Exactly.
He went berserk, and he couldn't accept that, and so he started living a life of crime. And I went a different way. I chose a different direction, and it's a fine line, folks. It's a fine line, and we all walk it at some point in time in our lives. We walk that fine line as to what direction do we, how do we respond to these kind of things. And you know, Ralph could have been an Olympic hero, and he ended up in prison, and then, unfortunately, he was actually murdered in a prison a couple of years later. And it just really hurt me that happened to a human being who was so close to sort of just becoming, you know, a hero. And then he ended up going this direction. It's just a tragedy, you know, to see that happen. And that's why I like to go around and talk to kids and try to get them to understand that, you know, don't give up. There's always a way. Never underestimate your own ability, you know, kind of a thing. You know, these are the lessons that I try to leave with people, you know, so.
Not everybody's good at sports. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
No, I mean, not everybody is just some, you know, great person in sports. People, I think people are so good at so many different things. The world's made up of all of us.
Yeah. Well, I run a lot, and I have five kids, and none of them run. You know, I'm not forcing that
really?
On them. They march to their own drummer. They do their own thing. You know, so which is great, and they excel at it, and they do well, and I'm proud of them. But you know, awesome. I mean, maybe someday they'll participate. They'll run a marathon, but you know, it's not in the cards right now, and I'm totally fine with something like that. You know.
Yeah.
And he's got the best holiday card every year. I love it. It's the whole family and the homestead and everything.
Right.
So tell us how the race has changed over the last, 25 years, physically changed and then the human element. Has that changed or is that still timeless?
Oh, I think the human element remains the same. You know, our race is very unique from any other marathon in the world in that it's all about the pursuit of athletic excellence. It gives everyone an opportunity to sort of, you know, go for the crown jewel, you know, the holy grail, if you will. It's the Super Bowl, it's the World Series in our industry, and you know, it's great. Whether it's Boston or it could have been some other race, it doesn't really matter. It just happens to be ours because it's the oldest, 117 years old, and been around for a long time, and you know, it grew pretty quick in 30 years ago, so they started imposing these qualifying standards in order to control the growth and whatnot. And then all of a sudden the qualifying aspect of it became the draw as much as the tradition and the history, and it just, you know, it just all pretty much took off. You know, the year before the 100th running of the Boston Marathon, 1996, we had 9,000 people in the race. The 100th, we had 38,000.
Wow.
So it went from 9,000 to 38,000, you know, and then it went back to like, we went back to like 10 or 11. And then it's been steady growth ever since. And by design, you know, I think if we opened it up and anybody and everyone who wanted to run it, we'd have over 100,000 people running in this race. But we, you know, the problem is that it's all about the real estate we have to work with. This race, again, was created 100 years ago for 100 people or 15 people, whatever, and small roads and everything else. And we have no more real estate today to put 36,000 people, which is what we're going to put on the course on April 21st, than they had, you know, 100 years ago when they put 15 people on the course. So, you know, it's a balancing act as to, you know, how many do you take. We're more about quality than we are quantity. We don't necessarily want to or need to be the biggest, you know, for me, as a technician, as the operation guy, as the logistics guy, you know, I want it to be the most well-run, you know, athletic competition that anyone has ever experienced. So that's where my MO has always been for this race.
And for those that don't know, the Boston Marathon has the deepest tradition, has the highest quality, is the best run race. Any runner who starts to, you know, feel their esteem grow and start to continue to polish their running skills, they hear about Boston, and then at some point in their running career, they want to pursue Boston. And so it's the pinnacle. He's correct. It is the Super Bowl of marathons, and it's the most well-run race, and that's Dave's brand. So for those that don't know, I appreciate him sharing that.
Well, again,
you're
only as good as the people you surround yourself with. I mean, I look at myself for the marathon as a caretaker. You know, it was here before I was born. It'll be here long after I'm gone. I'm just kind of taking care of it for a little while with a bunch of other people. And when people say, you're the race director, I said, yeah, but I'm more like the conductor. You know, you surround yourself with quality people, you know, experts in various disciplines, various aspects of the event, and they're the best at what they do in their area. And what I'm trying to do is sort of be the glue or the needle in the thread. It kind of keeps it all together, communicate with everyone, make sure everyone's getting along. And, you know, the thing is, the race is, like I said, you know, 100-plus years old. The biggest asset we have is you know, experience. We have people who've been involved in this for 30, 40 years. I mean, they've been here. They've been around since Sandwich was discovered, you know, and they bring a level of expertise and experience to the table second to none. So I'm very fortunate not that it's easy for me, but I'm very fortunate to have that kind of talent to work with. And the beauty about that, too, is that with a lot of other races I manage, you know, I'm creating something from nothing. They're new events, so you got to sort of start from scratch. This, you know, the basics are done. So then we can take aspects of the race, put it under a microscope, and really get into the weeds and develop various areas of the race that we have the opportunity to do so that other races don't. And that's why I think, you know, we're looked upon as setting the standard in the industry.
And you do. And I'll tell you, you know, Bob Babbitt introduced us, and he's the networker of all networkers as well. But the first time I met you, you were so warm, and you were the host. The best host, and we felt that. All of us felt that, and again, we really appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt that the Boston Marathon as an event is not my event or the BAA's event. It's the city's event. It's the country's event. It used to be called America's Marathon, you know, and so millions of people own the event, and that's how we treated, you know, that you all have a You're all stakeholders in this, you know, in this world class event. So this year, you know, it's going to be special, obviously, given, you know, the events of April 15th, 2013, and we're working really hard on, you know, just dealing with all the interest and the demand. We increased the field size from 27,000, which was a self-imposed field size limit for a number of years, to 36,000 to accommodate, you know, the incredible interest in this year's race. I mean, people, I mean, obviously the race kind of, quote-unquote, sold out, you know, right away. The race itself, we're going to try to maintain the competitive spirit. You know, the things we do leading up to the race will be the tributes and will be times for people to hail and remember. But the race itself, we got here because of who we are and what we mean to the running industry, and we want to maintain that. And so we're working hard at doing just that.
Such tremendous growth in this race. It looks like there's a new app out called the Boston Marathon World Run app, and a website that goes with it. It's such a neat thing because this is a really tough race to get into, right? 36,000 people, it's 9,000 more than last year, but there's still not quite enough room for everybody. How does somebody get to participate in the Boston Marathon if you're just a...
Well, we have qualifying standards, as everyone knows, and so based on your age and your gender, you have to meet those standards in order to at least be able to apply. Once you apply, then we ping your qualifying time against your own peers, if you will, and we take the best of the best. I mean, in essence, that's how our registration process goes now. So the marketplace actually sets the rates, if you will. You know, so if a lot of people do really well and beat their qualifying time by 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes during the course of the previous year, then it's going to be more difficult for people to get in who just beat their qualifying time by a minute or two than otherwise. And we have a charitable component, too, where we have official charities who, you know, the charities collectively raise, I don't know, $10 to $15 million a year. So a lot of goodwill, good work is being done, too. We have a very, we stick very tightly to a percentage of qualifiers versus non-qualifiers, because we always want to maintain the integrity of the competitive side of this event, too, while at the same time, you know, given back to the local community. So that's how people are able to participate in our race.
Dave?
I love it. Is there a website that goes with that, too? Is there a website that goes
BAA,
with the Boston Marathon?
Yeah, BAA.org.
Okay.
BAA.org. Dave, let me ask you something. How are you doing? Meaning, how are you doing? Because, you know, you are on a roll. And you know what you're doing, and you're a master at your craft. But what happened last year, and we'll just briefly chat about it because I know it's sensitive for everybody, but how are you and how are your team doing when something as just such a shift, an unexpected shift, happens not only then, but how are you guys doing now?
Yeah, everyone's doing fine. I mean, there are some who, you know, responded differently than others. For me, you know, interestingly, as a technician guy, as somebody who needs to be there for others, I need to take care of other people. It hasn't emotionally hit me to the point where I've you know, sort of gone down. I've had my game face on ever since the incident, both from a, you know, helping to recover to planning for this year, and so. My sense is that once this year's over, and I'm sure it'll all go well and whatnot, I think that's probably when it'll hit me the most, and I'll have time to reflect and that sort of thing. But for me, what happened on that day, you know, as we just spoke, you know, I run the race, you know, after pretty much everyone else, and that day we woke up. I mean, again, the year before we had the heat. A couple of years before that, we had a nor'easter. I mean, we've been challenged by Mother Nature like you wouldn't believe over the last few years. So we're thinking, okay, we, you know, give us a break. We need a good one here. And we woke up that morning, and it was a glorious day. The weather was perfect for a marathon, and everything was going great. And I got to the start, and that was all great. And the whole course was great. The finish was, everything was going great. Very few casualties in the medical tent, blah, blah, blah. And then I texted the executive director of the race, and I said, you know, it looks like everything's going well, automatic pilot, majority of people are done. Can I head back out and do my gig? And he said, beat it. You know, he texted me back, beat it. I thought, great. So I headed back to Hopkins. And when I got to Hopkins, it was 2:47 in the afternoon. And all of a sudden at 2:52, I get this phone call saying, you're not going to believe what I'm going to tell you, but there were two explosions. And so I didn't have to wait around at all. I just stepped back in the car, and state police escorted me back to the finish. They went 100 miles an hour down the Mass Turnpike, and I get in 20 minutes to the finish, and my first reaction was that my own family, my 9-year-old and 7-year-old, were in the bleachers. My wife was in the bleachers, and, you know, of course, I'm worried about everyone, but I'm particularly worried about them, and where did these bombs go off, and could they have gone off under the bleachers, and is my family even alive, and so all these things are going through my head, and you know, the first thing I did was I went into the medical tent just to see what was going on there and to try to help. And, you know, I saw a lot of patients, but none of them were runners. And that was an interesting, you know, thing to see. But I knew my skill set wasn't medical, so I left the medical tent and I said, I'm going to go up to the finish line and make sure my own family is okay and see what's going on up there. And all of a sudden a defining moment happened where a police officer just puts his hand up in front of my face saying, you're not going up there. And I said, well, I'm the race director. He said, I don't care who you are. You know, this is a crime scene, and you're not going up there. And that's when I realized this is bigger than a road race, and I'm no longer in charge of anything. And so I just headed down towards where the baggage buses were and started doing my job there, trying to reunite runners with their loved ones. And long story short. So a couple of days later, after all of that, I went home and I saw my 7-year-old for the first time since he saw what happened right there at the finish line. And he come up to me and he gave me a hug and he said, Dad, he says, I never, ever, ever want you to direct that race again.
Wow.
And for the first real time, it hit me that he associated danger with my job. And I realized there's a lot more victims than those who were physically hurt that day. You know, victims, my own son, my own 7-year-old, was an emotion, you know, he was victimized too. And so, you know, he had to see therapy and anyway, so, but, you know, we're all recovering. And about a month later, he come up to me and he said, Dad, he says, you know, that time I told you that I never wanted you to direct the Boston Marathon again. I said, yeah, Luke, I remember that. He says, you know why? I said, why? He said, because I want to direct it. I was like, wow.
So wow.
He came full circle. He processed it, you know, and then he realized, you know, he realized things in his head about it. You know, he got through it. And then he says, you know, I want to help now. You know, I got through this and I want to help now. Now, if my 7-year-old can do
that's
that.
That's so wise.
I'm saying, I gotta put my big boy pants on and you know and get back to work and make sure I set this thing up right the next time and be there for the survivors and all that. So and it's pretty interesting how the impact of that and how people respond differently to it.
Yeah, and you've got a team of people, right? 20, 30 people. What do you have?
Yeah, we have an organizing committee of, you know, 90-some-odd people and a staff of about 25 full-time people. I mean, not a big group of people. You know, there's a few people doing a lot of work. You know, but like I said before, you know, obviously they're an experienced bunch and they know what they're doing and, you know, I have every confidence in the world. And people say to me all the time, you know, you're standing at the starting line of the Boston Marathon, the helicopters are flying, there's 1,200 members of the media from all over the world, you've got runners from all over the world, 95 countries represented, you know, one of the most prestigious road races in the world, beamed all over, you know, whatever. Must be a lot of pressure. And I look at them and say, huh? Pressure's a privilege. It's a privilege. It's a privilege to do this. I mean, not everyone gets a chance to experience it this way. And I said, my main thing is I have to be prepared. And what saved us last year, you know, wasn't a plan on how to address something like that happening in particular, but it was more just the overall preparedness of the team. You know, we were prepared. And as a result, when you're prepared, you're confident. And so you're confident in your decision-making. So as that happened and people ran to and not from, and they saved lives, and then they took care of those who couldn't finish, and they responded. You know, a lot of us, like, were right there at the finish, and we were helping people, and we didn't know if there were more around, over there, behind this, in this trash can, whatever. And people stayed. The human spirit, you know, was exemplified like I've never seen it before. I mean, there could have been danger all around us. It wasn't like a building fire where people are stuck in a building, and you cordon that off, and that's the affected area, and everything else is okay. No, we didn't know from you know, sidewalk to sidewalk what we were getting ourselves into here. You know, I mean, this has never happened before, right? So it was pretty amazing. And then the response from the running community, and just the community at large. I mean, the posters and the banners and, I mean, our corridors in our office were like elementary schools with just stuff all on the walls from kids and people and runners signing things and Boston Strong and wanting to help us and be part of the healing process, and it continues today. It's amazing to be in the epicenter of all of it.
Wow, what an amazing! I mean, just I'm removed here. So, how is the spirit for this upcoming year, the race?
Well, I mean, again, we're motivated by the survivors. You know, I mean, a lot of them are going to participate. We have a 5K road race 2 days before, and some of them are going to participate in that. We've got all different things that are planned that should be announced pretty soon. So, you know, we're sort of gaining energy off of them. You know, it's our turn. So many people supported us right after the incident that now it's our time to step up and support them, is to give back to the city, you know, an opportunity, again, to remember, to pay tribute, to heal. And so the spirit is an all-time high. There were people who right afterwards said, do you think this is going to negatively affect the sport, that people are going to, like, go away because they're afraid? The opposite has happened. Races are selling out at record pace. People will not be denied their running freedom, and they're going to show these scoundrels that, you know, they're messing with the wrong group, you know, these runners, you know, and that, you know, they'll go to the end of the earth to sort of get a point across and to endure. And that's what we're seeing, you know, every single day, you know, leading up to this year's race.
Are you involved in any charitable sides to this upcoming year? Is there a way that listeners or our chat room or people that download, and by the way, this will be replaying, and I'm sure it'll be replayed and downloaded throughout this upcoming weekend on a large scale. So if anybody wants to donate or anybody wants to contribute something, what's the best way from your perspective?
I think the best way, I mean, generally the city created a charitable foundation called the One Fund,
right,
for the victims, you know, for the survivors. And some incredible amount of money obviously has been raised since, you know, somewhere in the $70-80 million. But all
wow.
that money goes to support them, help them, and whatnot. So, you know, you could just look up One Fund on the Internet and see the contact information and be able to contribute to that. You know, coincidentally, I'm actually going to Fenway Park right now. There's a kickoff for the new foundation called the Martin Riches Foundation, and that's the little boy, the 8-year-old boy that was killed at the marathon. And so they set up this foundation for him, and I just think there's a couple of hundred runners that are coming tonight who are running and raising money for that foundation. So we're
awesome.
We're kicking it off tonight.
I'll post
what's that?
Well, I was hoping maybe could you give that information to Gary so we could post that information for the show so listeners could participate in that?
Yeah, it's called the MRA Foundation, I think, Martin Richard, and he was 8 years old, so MRA. So if you look that up, you know, you can find that. Yeah. All right.
Can we ask you one more question? Just because we have a large main audience listening here today, too.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit of the races that you have here in Maine, because Maine's like this little gem spot for racing, and people might not know that Maine has some cool things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the most noted one is the TD Beach, the Beacon 10K. That happens every first Saturday in August. I think we're at our 16th year. Joan Benoit Samuelson, the 1984 Olympic gold medalist, founded it. She then hired me to be the race director, and I've been the race director since its inception.
Awesome.
And it's a diamond in the rough. I mean, we get 7,000 people. It sells out in like 4 minutes. Some of the best athletes in the world come and participate in it. Incredibly beautiful vista course. Point to point starts at the beach and then finishes at the lighthouse at Fort William, and
place,
the most photographed lighthouse in America. And so so that's you know obviously with the a non-marathon, it's my favorite non-marathon race of the year. The community gets behind it. It's everything
really
is like
popular.
Perfect about. Yeah, it's very popular. Everything's perfect about the event. So that's the only race that I actually direct in Maine. And then a week or two weeks later, I direct the New Balance Falmouth Road Race on Cape Cod. So those two events back-to-back obviously tax you in order to, in terms of, sort of erecting two major events back to back. But again, you surround yourself with the right team, you can put on a race on the moon if you want to, if you get the right people. So,
Dave,
that seems like it could be a goal of yours.
That's so
awesome.
Dave, you've been awesome. I want to
thank you.
Everybody, our audience wants to thank you. Very, very, very inspiring, very touching stories. You're so dedicated to what you do, and you so care about us just that, when we come swinging by your life. Dave answered my emails when I checked in on him post the event last year, and I couldn't even believe he was answering with everything that was going on. But we all appreciate it because I know I got a big running group here in L.A., and they were all checking in on you and wanted to just do whatever we could do to help. But, we appreciate it.
Yeah, you have two more minutes. I'll tell you one other thing I'll lead your audience with.
Please.
You bet.
Please, yeah.
Okay. So I've done all this running, and, of course, because of that, we athletes feel we're invincible, that, we're all like quasi-Superman, superwomen, and nothing's going to knock us down. In the last year and a half with my running, I started experiencing some shortness of breath when I start. And eventually it dissipates as I move along. But I knew something was wrong. So I checked with my doctors, and they did stress tests, EKGs, all kinds of stuff. And nothing. So the good news was that I was fit. And, anything that was going on, I was compensating for it. But the bad news was that I was fit and maybe masking something that was eventually going to get me. And I was getting frustrated because I knew something was wrong, but all the tests were saying nothing's wrong. So I said to my doctor, you got to give me the big tests. You got to look under the hood. So only 3 months ago, they did a CAT scan and they found stuff. And then they did an angiogram and found more stuff. And it was amazing, surreal, that I was lying on an operating table looking up at these monitors, seeing my arteries in my heart and thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening to me. I've run across the country, up the coast. I am how can this be happening?
Dave, and, of all people.
Yeah, and it's in the, I came to the conclusion it's in the gene pool. And But at the same time, I probably could have been more vigilant and more attentive to my diet, too. I mean, I never abused, but, you can always do better. And so, long story short, my doctor says that, if you do the right things, you can probably reverse this. So in the last 3 months, I've changed everything. I've been really strict on diet and other things, lifestyle, eliminating stress, sleeping more. My motto used to be sleep's overrated. I'll sleep when I'm dead, because I'm trying to get as much as I can out of every single day. But that doesn't cut it, right?
Right.
So I'm paying a lot more attention. I've lost, not that I had to lose it, but I lost 27 pounds in the last 3 months. I lowered my cholesterol level by 70 points.
Nice.
I feel as fit, if not fitter, than I've ever felt in my life. I'm running strong. The breathing problem I had for a year and a half has gone away.
Nice.
So the takeaway is this. I spent my whole life, Gary and Elizabeth, I spent my whole life working hard at being fit, but I never worked hard at being healthy.
Exactly.
And because I always thought that fit meant healthy, and it doesn't. It doesn't. And I learned that lesson at age 59.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to tell people, no matter what age you are, understand fit does not necessarily mean healthy. I can name 6 personal friends of mine who were Olympic trial competitors who went out for a run one day and never come home.
Oh.
And I was very fortunate that I was able to detect this on my own and
help.
Do something about it. And hopefully, I didn't miss the bus here. I'm saving my own life. So
you are.
My goal now is to maybe do Iron Man this October, which I never would have considered doing.
Another Iron Man.
So I want to go back to Hawaii after 25 years, and I turned 60 years of age, and so I have a target to shoot for, and if I can get myself back and strong again, that's That's my goal.
Here's the challenge, Dave. On air, here's the big challenge. You do it at 60. I'll do it at 60. I'll be 3 years from now. I'll be 60. So
all right.
Put the mark down for me.
Quiet. You know, another thing there that I just want to mention too that is really neat is you're a guy, obviously. Guys aren't so vocal about their health.
I know
a lot of guys, and my dad included, who's like, I'm macho, nothing wrong with me, all that stuff that guys do that they don't want to go to the doctor or anything. And I hear that all the time, asleep when I'm dead. And you just nix that completely.
Well, the reason being
guys,
is this,
listen to this,
and
I'll leave you
with this. As soon as I got the word from my doctor, they wheeled me out of the operating room. I went to my cardiologist and my wife, and I pointed at them, and I said, you will not say a word to anyone about this.
Nice.
Because I was more embarrassed than I was.
Exactly.
I didn't want to come clean. I didn't want anyone to know that I was invincible, that I wasn't invincible, right? And then all of a sudden it leaked out a little bit, and then people started coming to me and said, geez, Dave, if it can happen to you, it can happen to me. I'm going to go get checked. And I started realizing, quit being so selfish. Quit being so selfish to retain this and keep this inside because of maybe some of my notoriety and other stuff, and maybe I can get the good word out and I can help save lives. So I've decided, I'm just coming clean with this, and maybe it'll give everyone a wake-up call saying, I'm going to go get checked out.
And it's
so
healing to you. It's healing to you as well.
Right. Good point. So.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
You're on,
Dave. Excuse me. Oh, man. It makes me cry. Sorry. That's my little tear.
Thank you so much. You're awesome. We'll stay in touch. Yeah, we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
All right.
And good luck with your health. And say hi to the family. Thank you.
I will.
Thank
you so much. Very kind. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow.
Oh, he's so cool.
And he's like, hey, wait a minute. I got two more minutes. I love that. Hey, but wait a minute. I got two more minutes.
Hang on.
I have one more story. Oh, by the way, I just about went down myself, but here's the moral. I love it.
He's
the best. He's the master. He's the king of event planning and still learning at 59.
And he shares. That's a really good lesson for men, is sharing emotions and feelings and thoughts. And because there are a lot of guys out there who would say, yeah, I got picked last all the time.
No, and I love his son wants to take over.
For the race. Yeah.
Move aside, Dad, when you're ready.
Move over.
I'm ready.
So,
that is so great.
All
right,
cool.
Super.
Yeah.
And tonight, Vince Vaughn's mom, Shay Vaughn, that's tonight at the Best Ever You Late Night. And the last few days, just phenomenal. Elizabeth, you holding up?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. He made me cry. Sorry.
Oh.
That's a really powerful speaker and person. And so I can go on and on and on. I have to play that over and over and over and over and over again. And I wish there are some things that I wish I had in my toolbox when I was a kid. So I try and one of the things that I love to do with Best Ever You is share these shows with kids. Because that could change a kid's life. I mean, who knows who's listening? Parents, show this to your kids if you've got a kid that doesn't feel so good. They're getting picked last. Or even if they're getting picked first, to maybe be mindful of picking the kids that don't get picked all the time.
Yeah. Can you tell us how to get involved, the downloads and replays? And
love
then,
it.
And then maybe just a little props here to to our sponsors.
We're besteveryou.com/teleconference, and I think one of the beauties of all of this is that you can download and replay and share these shows as much as you want. They're always here, and the links are up on besteveryou.com/teleconference. We're also sending emails out to everybody that registers, and if you do register for the conference, everybody who registers is automatically entered to win an iCoffee. And that's iCoffee.com, and we'll be giving one of those away. And we thanked Blog Talk Radio a lot, but I just really appreciate everybody there. And drink Re as well. We were talking about that earlier. It's not one of those energy drinks with caffeine and all that. It's a pure vegetable and fruit
21 fruits.
Fruit, sorry. Sorry if I misspoke there. Get tired. Pure fruit drink, and that's at drinkree.com. So that's all I got. I'm going to go.
Awesome.
Go rest and relax and think about everything he just said.
Awesome. And we'll see everybody tonight, 8 Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern. Best ever you late night, Shavon, Vince
Bonsman.
Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks.
Talk to everybody later. Bye.
Right, bye.
Thank you for listening to the What's Percolating teleconference on Blog Talk Radio. Please visit us at besteveryou.com for more ways to percolate and create your best life.